Hi, I'm Bob Earl. I am a drug addict and an alcoholic. That's not going to work, but we'll... That's okay. Hi, God, I'm glad to be here. Showed up, surprised. You know, I don't understand why people are so surprised when I show up. I had one bad year, you know, that's it. I missed 5 conferences 1 year, that's it. You know, fuck it, I tried, you know. We always want to keep people in a box, you know. Whatever they did 12 years ago, we want to figure they're still the same way today, and then we wonder why nobody grows and changes in the program. I've always known. The thing I learned about me is that I don't judge people. Judgment is lightweight. I don't think we judge here in AA. I think we condemn. You know? I mean, a guy can do something off the wall, see, and I'll say, he's really a dumb son of a bitch, you know. Now, I won't see, this may be Henry, right? Now, I don't see Henry for 10 years. And somebody will come up to me and say, you know Henry? I haven't seen Henry in 10 years, right? Yeah, I know Henry. He's a dumb son of a bitch, you know. He likes to chew on his socks in the parking lot after meetings. I mean, he may have given it up, but I won't give him credit for giving it up, you know. I keep him the same. I'm glad to be here. I feel pretty good. I'm in good humor. I love Cindy's talk. I don't agree with it, but I love it. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm not. But they're relapses. We used to call them slippers. And they used to scare me to death at meetings when they talked when I was new. Absolutely scared me to death. Boy, they get up with a casual attitude about, well, I've been coming around here for about 4 years now. I got enough goddamn poker chips to start a poker game, and you know, I'll get it one of these days. It's really okay. I got a little shit faced last night. Wasn't too bad, you know, but sure appreciate this opportunity to share and sit down. And boy, I get just like, I'd want to die. I'd get panic stricken, you know, because to me it was like I had this thing like I was so afraid of going back to where I'd come from. Of having to live that life again, of having to go through that hell again, that this casual attitude about it scared me, because I thought, I can't get that, you know, loose about it. Because if I get that loose about it, I feel like Cindy, I won't die either, unfortunately. You know, I would like to think, I think a lot of us would like to think that we would go out in this great blaze of glory and be gunned down, you know, in the streets and make, you know, headlines in the newspapers and 6 o'clock news, you know, if not the network news, really, if we did it right. And reality is we probably just stay sick and sorry and live in doorways and throw up a lot and wet our pants and not be too beautiful, you know. And it's like, so with that waiting for me, the people who had drank and came back and had a casual attitude about it scared me to death. You know, I don't know that I'm right on this subject, so if it's getting you crazy, relax. You know, I may change my mind in the walk from here back up the street to the motel. So if it keeps you up, you know. But one of the opinions I have formulated in the time that I've been sober around Alcoholics Anonymous that I consider, in its way, one of the major tragedies of AA, is that we reward failure more than we reward success here. And we pay more attention to failure than we do success here. And it seems that sometimes it's like, I know for me, I got here when everybody turned their back on me. And there was nobody else, you know. And I have worked with people who have drank and used, mostly used, time and time again. And sometimes it's when I threw them out, you know, and told them I'd kill them next time I saw them, you know. Practicing true brotherly love in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I see you loaded again, you're dead. They cleaned up their act. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that from two people, I'm dangerous with my hands. Well, I don't repair things for a living. You watch me, you'd understand why. You have from two different people you who love each other, two different points of view. And that in and of itself is healthy for both of us. You know, that one of us doesn't have to agree and concur with the other one on what they've just said. And so I don't know what the right thing is. You know, I think I would rather see us here when a guy comes into the meeting and he just got a big new job, gonna pay him $100,000 a year, and he's so stoked he can't even sit still on his chair, right? I like to see us cheer him, you know. I like to see us stand up and applaud and sing a song for him, rather than, you know, the only people, I gotta tell you, from personal experience in AA, man, you walk into a meeting and let them know you really hit it big, you know, really hit in your home group where they know you well, right? And already don't like you for a multitude of whatever reasons, you know. And you walk in and say, I just got this goddamn job, gonna pay me $100,000 a year, and I'm so happy I can't stand it, right? And the only people who will come up to you afterwards are those who want something, right? They figure you somehow can help them. But lose your ass. Lose it all, and you'll get more attention than you can handle. You know, if you go up and you stay fair, you look and say, boy, you know, I just did it today. It just really lost it all, you know? Everything. Gonna have to go bankrupt. It's been really terrible. And then you sit down, and here they are. All of it. Did you really lose everything? Even the car? Because he's hated your goddamn car for a year, you know. And the only reason I can think of that we do that, because I used to do it, and I used to have those attitudes, is because I never thought I would have that stuff. So if I figure I'm never going to get it, if you got it, I really don't like you. Because you got something I'm never going to have, and if I had any chance of getting it, you got mine. So so I know now it's finished, so you know, you and I don't have anything to talk about. And it appears to me that the reason that I held those beliefs so long to the sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I didn't care about me. You know? I am becoming really, for somebody who's not yet attended a meeting, but am versed with, well, not a little bit knowledgeable anyway, in the precepts of the adult children of alcoholics, I am becoming convinced that in 10 years that organization will be the same size as ours. I am convinced of it. And I'll tell you why. So many of us are adult children of alcoholics here in AA. But I'm one of these people who worked this program to the best of my ability with all the insanity that an alcoholic and a drug addict who lived in the streets can bring to the program, and all of the intensity and all of the energy. I did everything my sponsors asked. I hated it, but I did it, you know, because I was all under threat of death or broken bones. But I did it. I worked the program. I wrote countless inventories. I worked the steps. I drove tens of thousands of miles every year to institutions to carry the message. I had hundreds of babies. I had people throwing up in my house, in my car, everywhere I lived. You know, I had guys. I was always up all night to keep dopey from stealing. You know, if you got dopey kicking, you got to nail stuff down, lock the door. You know, you have to rearrange your whole house, right, when you bring a friend in to kick a habit just so he doesn't take it with him, you know, when he leaves. I mean, I lived like that for years. I did all of these things that this program asked me to do, and I wrote inventories, and I did all of it. And yet, when I rolled into 17 years of sobriety, I was still not really happy. I was still not really living life. Oh, yeah, I had good things going on, because at 5 years of sobriety, I wanted to die so bad I finally surrendered to God. I'll get to that in a minute. But even God in His own his grace, as I understand Him, although He poured into my life all those things that they tell you He'll pour into your life, if you really let go, I couldn't enjoy Him. I was always worried about Him being taken away. I was always worried about being found out. I was always worried it wasn't going to last long. I was never going to take another chance like the last chance, because this one worked out, but the next chance won't work out. I knew all that. I mean, I couldn't just relax and smile and stroll down the street in good health and live life. Yet I was 17 years in this program. I had done everything I could do. And it was at that time in my own life it was suggested to me to try therapy. And I did. And you know, it's now 4.5 years later, and I'm 21 and a half years sober, and I am. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm so grateful for it. And I'll get into that in a little while too. But the one thing that happened was interesting. Maybe a lot more things happened. But the major thing that seemed to happen is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the focus is on me. And the focus is on what I did to you. That's it, you know. That's all my sponsors wanted to hear. Who'd you rob? Who'd you shoot? You know, who'd you steal from? I mean the list, right? You know, all of it, you know. All the people I owed amends to. All the people that I had done wrong. All the people that I had harmed physically, emotionally, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Time and time again, I wrote these inventories. Who do I owe amends to? Who have I hurt? What did I do to so-and-so? What did I do here? What did I do there? What, I mean, and critical, super critical of myself. Now, along comes an organization that says, children raised in an alcoholic home have some serious adjustment problems in life because it is not a quote, normal, unquote, childhood. So what they do is they say, look at what happened to you. Look at what was done to you. Look at the beatings you took. Look at the abandonment you suffered. Look at the pain inflicted on you. And it's like, in therapy, in essence, as I see it today for me, that's all that happened for me. After 17 years of working this program to the best of my ability, somebody changed the focus and said, what happened to you? What was done to you? Why are you 17 years sober, successful, and miserable? Unable to enjoy, unable to feel any sense of satisfaction. And I was struggling, man. I was trying to do good things. I'd already quit smoking. I'd already quit eating meat. You know, I was trying to do something. I was trying. I knew that there was there is a way or a path or a healthy life, and there's a piece of me that hungered for it and really wanted it, but it's like there's a bigger piece of me which is keeping me down, you know, in the muck and the mire. Okay. Enough generalization. Let's get to the specifics. I arrived here at 26 years of age. I was a youngster in those days, in AA, one of the young people. Today it seems almost ridiculous. And I'm really glad of that. I am really glad of that. And I was living outdoors and weighed 135 pounds and was almost dead. A few interesting things happened. I was taken to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by a couple of Eskimos. Like, I will get to Eskimos too in a minute. And I talk a lot about the mind because in sobriety, the only enemy I have run into is my mind. The only real dangerous thing in my sobriety has been my thinking. No one else would dream of doing to me what I dream of doing to me. No one would be courageous enough to say to me what I say to me. Nobody would put me down like I put me down. I mean, this sucker just whirs up here all the time. You know, it's like being in the day room of a mental hospital with all the, you know, you wake up in the morning and all the voices are there, right, to greet you. You know, good morning, we're glad you're up. We want to discuss the day with you. It's going to be a tough day, probably one of the hardest you've ever had in your sobriety. It's conceivable that staying in bed will be the smartest thing that you can do today. You haven't had enough sleep, you're going to screw up on the job and get fired. The odds are that the bump on your knee is bone cancer and you're going to die within 6 months. And how are you going to handle that? Are you going to go to meetings and talk about it? Or are you going to be chicken shit and stay home and rot to death, you know, and not tell anybody? And if you lose your job, you're in serious trouble because you got about 6 weeks to survive financially, so you're broke. You know, so you've been awake about 10 seconds, and with a little help from yourself, you're unemployed, headed for poverty, and near death, you know. Which makes starting the day, you know, I don't know any alcoholics that jump up, you know, and go roaring into the morning, hey, God's given me another day to enjoy, you know, this is great, you know. They shuffle and drag to the coffee pot like they're headed for the heroin, you know. Followed by a cigarette, we're all into health here, you know. Those of you who know me know I'll get to the smoking before long. I can't let it go. I can't stand to watch people I love kill themselves. So anyhow, yeah, right. Yeah. Non-smokers applaud. Applaud yourselves. I walked into this first AA meeting with the clothes on my back, almost dead. The brains had long been fried by mixtures of strange chemicals and electric shock, and enough thorazine to kill an army. Compliments of being housed by various psychiatric institutions in the state of California that wanted to study me. And then they got to get you quiet enough to study you, and then they don't know who you are. I love that one. I can never figure that one out, you know. They got you whacked on so much thorazine you can't even stand up. They want to find out how you react to life. You know. Yeah. Catch me clean and sober 3 days off my drugs and find out how I react to life, you know, badly. So I bring this person into AA and I sit him down in a chair and I'm in a quiet little, in Altadena, California. How I wound up in Pasadena, I'll never know, but my first meeting was in Altadena, which is even a quieter community than Pasadena, right? And I'm in this little American Legion Hall in this nice little AA meeting with nice people, all nicely dressed and quiet and polite and bouncing around, you know, and just friendly. And I sit there and they put the coffee in front of me and I'm lapping it, you know, like a dog because I can't pick it up. My mind, this fine-tuned piece of machinery I have, looks around this AA meeting and all these people and it says to me, boy, you have sunk to the bottom of the barrel this time. This is the end of the road. The fun is over. Now, although that's a humorous statement, it's also a dangerous statement. And I'll tell you why. What it set up in me was, it set up in me the attitude that AA is what you do between drinking and using and dying. Okay? You can't drink or use anymore, so you hang out in AA and you don't drink or use until you die, and that's what we do here. Well, if this program is the end of the road, how much energy are you going to put into it? I mean, if this is just a holding pattern until you kick the bucket, why work the steps? How many people do you know take the book and embrace it with love and sit down and then just go after the steps with this fervor and enthusiasm? Or do most of them work the step when they can't reach anybody on the phone, they're three quarters crazy and ready to blow their brains out? You know, I know when I work my steps, I can find dust on most people's books. I know. Just go wipe it up. Say, how do you feel? Not good. Oh, gee. Wipe a little dust off the book. So, although I knew that this was just a holding action, my sponsors put me to work in AA, and I did all the crap. I set up the chairs. I made the coffee. I mopped the floors. All this stuff. I hated every minute of it. I'm grateful that my sponsors had enough sense to know the attitudes that I had, and they warned me that I would hate every minute of it. And said it was okay, I didn't have to like it, I just had to do it. They told me that for me to wait for the proper motivation to do anything would be fatal, okay? There's a Dodge van in Bouncy parking lot behind our building. It's an Oregon license, it's HJM321, light blue or green. Must be moved or towed. HJM321 Dodge van. I'd wait 2 or 3 minutes till the people have forgot the announcement, then sneak out and move it. Or get up, go out the exit towards the bathroom, you know, with a pained look on your face. Now I'm into terminal cool, too. That's something that almost killed me. Look good at all costs, even though you're dying. Dying looking good is more important than living looking bad. One of the problems I always had with life is rigidity, and life doesn't seem to be too rigid. It seems to be spontaneous, and I have seen rigidity destroy more sober alcoholics than anything else. Resistance to change, I've seen kill a couple of my sponsors. Send them back out there and they died. Okay. So I go about taking care of business in AA only because I'm instructed to take care of business with no love for anybody or any of the things that I'm doing. I hated going to the institutions, hated going to the hospital, hated mopping floors. Oh, I can't tell you how bad I hated mopping floors. I had been beaten half to death in institutions that wouldn't mop the floor, you know, I mean. And here I am in AA, supposedly, you know, with this little great gratitude smile going around mopping the floor, you know, which I still hang on to that one 21 years later. I hate it. I'd still like to, but yeah, never mind, forget all that. So I go through a couple of years of sobriety and doing the best I can, and I'm having one serious problem is that I can't talk to God. Now, I can't talk to God because it's only one thing you guys keep saying. See? I mean, you guys keep saying to me, God as you understand him. That's lethal. You know, I think we should help the poor new guy out. Give him a God to work with, you know. The one we bring in isn't too terrific. Okay? So you say to me, God as you understand him, and I immediately, and I have no formal religious training of any kind. Okay? A couple of missions. You know, few come to Jesus on a sunbeam before you eat and get a bowl of soup. But that's it, okay? That's all I know, right? So the only image I have of God is the old man in the sky sitting in the throne with a book keeping score. Now you say to me, trust him. And I say to you, he and I aren't even yet. I'd like to trust him, but I have this very sinking feeling that he's waiting for me. That probably the dumbest thing I could do would be stand out in the open somewhere and say, take me, I'm yours. And I hated that prayer, do with me as thou wilt. No, you're not on your life. But you go to meetings and people are praying and their prayers are getting answered. You know, a guy will stand up at your local participation meeting who you absolutely can't stand at all, right? The one guy you really hate. Worse than the rest of them. Well, geez, you know, I got up this morning, my wife served me with divorce papers, and I really broke my heart, and I went into work, and I'd be damned, the company decided to lay me off, and I went out to drive home to get my stuff and move it out, and my car had been repossessed, and I didn't know what to do. I was totally distraught, so I went back into the company where I work and knelt down in the men's room on the floor and said, God, I don't know what to do. Please fix all this. And I'm here tonight and happy to report that my wife changed her mind and has let me stay, and they gave me my job back, and I picked my car up in the morning. And you sit there and go, boy, I could use some of that. You know, I mean, I'm running around here on red alert. I haven't been this tense since I was drinking and using. You know, my neck is cocked over to one side. I got a knife between my shoulder blades trying to be relaxed, you know, a year and a half sober. So I'd hear a talk like that. I'd say, I'm going home now, and God and I are going to put it together now, and things are going to change now. And I'd run home, get in the house, overlap the drapes because my sponsors had told me I had to pray on my knees. I didn't want anybody to see me. Look good at all costs, right? Oh, Jesus. So I get next to my bed, you know, kneel down, fold my hands, bow my head. And the minute I bowed my head, the mind would say, forget it. God only works for the good people, and you are not one of the good people. I could accept that. See, I couldn't accept that God loved me, but I could accept that I was not one of the good people. I could not accept that I was a pure, beautiful child of God, born in perfection, you know, screwed over by two parents, and then, you know, left to drug addiction and alcoholism, and then arrived here. I couldn't accept that. I could just accept I was no good. So I operated a couple of years in AA this way, unable to talk to God. I went to a meeting one night, and in this meeting, a guy told a story. I tell this now, I don't know why, but it came to light a while back. I talked to some other people about a year ago who were at this same meeting, and they say he didn't tell the story. It's okay, I was only 2 years sober. I was hearing a lot of things, and it changed my life, so I heard the story. I don't know who the hell told it, but I did hear the story. There was two guys drinking in a bar in Alaska. One was an atheist, the other was a very religious man. Eventually, their conversation swung around to God. The atheist looked at the religious man. He said, I don't believe in your God. Religious man says, why not? Atheist said, I gave your God a chance to prove himself to me once, and he didn't do it. Religious man says, in what manner did you give God a chance to prove himself? Atheist says, well, about 6 months ago, I was lost about 150 miles north of town in a blizzard, and I knelt down in the snow, and I looked at the sky, and I said, God, if there is one, I'm lost, and I'm going to die. Religious man smiles a very knowing smile. He says, well, you must believe you're here. Atheist said, nah, some goddamn Eskimo came along and showed me the way back to town. So I'm sitting in this meeting and I hear this story, right? Now, one of my sponsors was an absolute maniac with a voice that was incredible. I mean, I watched him literally, this is the truth. He turned the microphone aside in one of the anniversaries of one of the penitentiaries in California with an auditorium of 1,000 people because he didn't need the microphone in order to be heard in the back, right? He never talked softly in his life. And particularly when he was taking my inventory at meetings, he never could muffle it, you know. So, but the only time he'd talk softly, he'd say, the kingdom of heaven is inside of you. Inside of you. Stop looking every place else. It's inside of you. And I don't know how you handle your sponsors, but I always agree. You know, it's the easiest way to end the goddamn conversation. You know, yeah, right, I got it. Yeah, sure, I understand. I'm thinking, you lunatic, don't be ridiculous. You know, God is good, I'm no good. How can God be inside of me? You know. So I'm thinking, and I've heard the story, and I think, my sponsor said God is inside of me. And then I think how I got to AA. I'm sitting in this doorway. I couldn't call AA. Couldn't call. I had a dime. I had the phone number. I had had it for weeks. I would go to the payphone. I would drop the dime in. I'd hear the dial tone. I'd hang up and walk away because, you see, I'm the kind of personality that could not call people in an office I had never met. It wouldn't matter if I didn't know them. And say, I can't make it. I'm out here dying. I wouldn't admit defeat. I would rather die than admit defeat. So one day I'm sitting in my little doorway with my dime and my newspaper ad in my pocket, and this voice says, hey, man, if you don't have a place to stay, come stay with me and the old lady. And I look up, and here's a guy who owes me a fortune, right? Because I had a Robin Hood complex when I was stealing. It helped assuage the guilt. So this guy, his old lady, and their six kids have been on welfare ever since I've known him, right? And he's into me like $5,000 or $6,000. So I can go stay with him. God understands me, you know. It's not charity. It's the code of the streets. Son of a bitch owes it to me to take me out of my doorway and put a roof over my head, you know. I go home with him. I'm sitting on the couch in this one-bedroom apartment that the eight of them are living in. Wall-to-wall cockroaches, some I brought, of course, in my mind. Others were real there, you know, because they squished. I could tell when I stepped on them. I'm sitting in this apartment, and I'm shaking, and I'm falling apart. And I said, hey, you know, man, one of these days I got to call this AA thing and do something about my drinking. He says, there's a girl down the hall goes to AA. Now, this is 1962. I didn't even know women went to AA. And one thing, I had no conception of what the hell one looked like. I mean, what would a woman look like that went to AA? I mean, it was inconceivable to me, you know. So I wanted to find out. So I went down the hall to see what the hell a girl who goes to AA looks like, right? And I knocked on the door. Once again, God in his infinite wisdom, these were my Eskimos. These people were my Eskimos. Put right in front of me by God. I don't know why I was chosen. I have absolutely no idea at all. I just walked down the hall, knocked on the door because I was curious to see what a broad looks like goes to AA, right? I knock on the door. Now, God knew if she had been some very adorable little damsel standing there with little puffy sleeves and lace, I would have lied without even thinking about it. I wouldn't have had time. I mean, the minute I saw her, I would have just started with some spiel about standing there in the only clothes I'd been in for months, right? Well, I understand that you have a knowledge of an organization that deals with alcoholism. I have a father who has a severe drinking problem. Perhaps you could dispense some information that would enable me to assist my poor sick father with his disease, you know. Didn't have to worry about it. The girl opened the door, is big enough to break every bone in my body. She stood about 6'2", 6'3". She was built like a professional football fullback. She had short black hair and tattoos all the way down both arms and both legs. She had a half full pint of booze in her hand. This is my introduction to AA. And then we walk around here saying, be careful what you say to the newcomer. Why? You know, where the hell do you think they're coming from, for Christ's sake? But I take one look at her, see, and God, who understands me, he knows that what I'm going to think. I'm home. This is okay. She's street people. I can talk to her, you know. So I look at her, right, and I said, you know, hey, I'm curious about this A thing. She stands there with her half full pint of booze, looks me right in the eye. I said, A will work if you want it, and I am not ready to quit drinking. Made perfect sense to me. See? I'm almost dead, okay? I'm skinny. I look like a fugitive from a concentration camp. I'm almost dead. I look at her and I think, if I was a big, tough broad, I wouldn't quit either. You know? If I had her size and strength, I'd be back out the door in 2 minutes. You know, I'm only here because I can't breathe anymore, you know? I can't think and I get lost a lot walking up and down the alley. She felt the responsibility for the sobriety she had, so she stuck me in a car and took me to an AA meeting. 28th of August, 1962. Been clean and sober ever since. Those are my Eskimos. My Eskimos. One took me out of the doorway, one took me to the meeting. So now here I am, 2 years sober, and I've just heard this Eskimo story, and I'm so jacked up I can't stand it. You know, it's like, I got it, I understand it. If God's in me, he's in everybody. If he's in everybody, the only instrument he has to work with is people. I can understand people showed up all the time in my life to help me out. The only thing that's kept them from helping me is me. You know. Now, thanks. Yeah, I appreciate your offer. I mean, nobody can make my life as hard as I can. Nobody would want to. Nobody would be that interested. So now I decide I've got it wired, and I go home. It's interesting how we... My most serious problem, this is according to me and the lady who's been treating me for 4.5 years now, is I have a habit of compartmentizing things. I figure all tall people are alike, all short people are alike, you know, all people from the south are alike, all people from the north are alike, all whites are alike, all Mexicans are alike, all black, you know, that makes it easy for me, you know. I just don't have to deal with anything, you know, just... I'd go there, but I know what it's like, so I don't have to go. So that's my big problem, right? And the funny thing is, we do that with God, or I did that with God, because I go home armed with this Eskimo story, and I sit down in my chair, which is fatal, always. A psychiatrist in a book said that the armchair is the neurotic spaceship. Where we sit and think. I want you to know that think was not one of the original signs in AA. It was sent by the printer. It ain't in the book. It was a mistake. Right? So I go home to my think chair and I sit down. I have never in 21 years thought my way through anything. Nothing. I have thought my way into indigestion, into being awake for 3 days, into sickness, into anxiety to the point where I can't breathe, but I've never thought my way through anything. I have acted my way through a lot, but not thought. So anyway, I go home, I sit in this chair, I'm happy understanding God, and my mind says to me, well, yeah, okay, you know, big deal. All right, so God is in everybody, it works through people. But there's three areas of your life he isn't interested in. And I say to my mind, really? What are they? Now, understand that today in my life, I do not ask my mind questions. The only question I ever ask my mind today is, what is your source of information? Because it has no education and it talks all the time about everything. You know. So I don't really want to, you know anymore what it has to say. I like the line, it says it's an excellent servant and a terrible master, you know. So anyhow, I say to my mind then, not knowing any better, oh, well, what areas of my life is God not interested in? And it says, well, first of all, money. God does not care about money. He isn't interested in money, whether you have it or whether you don't have it. Thought about it for a minute. watched a lot of fundamentalist Christian television, believed that poverty was, you know, the best thing for me. So I accepted the fact that God didn't care whether I had money or not. So I said, okay, well, what else? My mind says to me, employment. God does not care where you work. And I thought about that for a minute, and it makes good sense, you know? I mean, with this whole planet to take care of, with all of us to take care of, with all the problems going on, what the hell would some deity care about where you punch a clock? You know, I mean, I understood that. It made good sense. Things that make sense to me, I don't do anymore. I do what's illogical. What's illogical is good for me. What's logical is never good for me. I said, what else? I said, relationships. God doesn't care who you date, who you go out with. Just don't, you know, harm any of your sisters intentionally and have a good time. It's my interpretation of it anyway. So I say, oh, okay, I got it. You know, God's keeping me clean and sober, and I got to take care of money, employment, and relationships. I can handle that. All right? By this time, I'm just 2 years sober. So I spend the next 2 years. I'll do it the other way. Because I was a little tense when I got here, and a little angry when I got here, and had a background of questionable peacefulness, it seemed that people found fit in the beginning to give me those guys to sponsor who were insane. People who had blown up buildings with people in them for something to do. Guys had done half their life for murder. I mean, these are the ones I got. People who like to hurt people. Now, There's one thing in common among all the psychopaths, and it is that we do like to look good and never admit we need anything. We take everything. So, these guys would never call for help, ever. I don't care how bad the pain was, they would never call for help. As I never called for help. I never, ever, in my early sobriety, called one of my sponsors in the middle of the night. I'd stay up. I'd pace, I'd be in a rage, I'd put my fist through the wall, I always hit a stud, of course. God's little sense of humor. Son of a bitch thinks he's tough, we'll give him 3 busted knuckles, see how cute he thinks he is. So I'd do all that alone, I'd never call and ask for help. But on a rare occasion that one of these maniacs would call me in and ask me for help, it would mean that he had drug himself crying, screaming across the carpet by his fingernails, pulled the phone off the nightstand, dialed, and they would cry into your ear, I can't goddamn take it anymore. The source of this phone call was always one of 3 things, money, employment, or women. The very 3 areas I'm supposed to take care of in my life. Well, I did take care of them. I did the very best job I could. I applied all of my intellect and all of my physical energy to money, employment, and women. 4 years sober, a few days before my 4th AA birthday, I had just gone financially bankrupt through the courts. My car was gone. It went into bankruptcy. I had no place to live. I was sleeping on a couch in a guy's apartment I didn't even particularly like, but he was 2 doors away from the car wash where I was working for $1.25 an hour. I was handling employment. I had started at $1.35 an hour. For those of you who have been in institutions a lot over the years, you know you sit on a lot of concrete. If you sit on a lot of concrete, you get hemorrhoids. Okay, so now I'm bouncing in and out off these hot car seats all day long, and my hemorrhoids are coming back. I haven't been with a girl in so long, I'm crazy, right? I mean, I can't even get anybody to go to coffee with me at a meeting. They can see you coming clear across the room. They know you really don't want to have coffee. You know, you're just a pimp. I had borrowed money from everybody I sponsored. I was humiliated every time the central office called me with a 12-step call because, first of all, the guy had to have a car, and secondly, he had to be sober to drive the car so he could pick me up so I could take him to the meeting. Generally, I wasn't thrilled with the condition of my life 4 years sober, but I had done the best job I could. Now, I didn't take a cake either. Friends said, you got to take a cake. You know, take a cake. I said, what for? What am I going to do? Am I going to get up to a podium and tell a newcomer this is what he can have? Huh? come in here and hang on for 4 years, don't drink, don't use alcohol, you can be broke working in a car wash for $1.25 an hour, you know, so horny your eyes are crossed and your hemorrhoids coming back? Yeah, you know. I'm sure he'd stay for the end of the meeting, you know. So an Eskimo drives through the car wash and offers me a better job. This Eskimo says to me, "What are you doing working here?" I was the only one in the car wash spoke English. I said, I don't know, you know. I had to lie to get the job, too. I had to tell the guy I was going to summer school, you know. He said, "Why do you want a job in the car wash for?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to school. I just need a little part-time job to help me out here." So he says, "Come work for us. You know, we'll pay you 50 cents an hour more than you're making here, and it's, you know, 3 blocks down the street, and I could still walk to work." So I took the job. It was an easy job. And I had the job for almost a year. I don't see how much of this is important. It's every night, this always happens when you talk, I don't know if that's when you talk, it always happens when I, the one nice thing about four and a half years of therapy is that all of these voices down here, I have gotten them down to four. Which is hope. I mean, for me, it may not be for you, but it's delightful for me. I can cope today quite well. But the four forget they have one mouth. And they, you know, everybody tries to speak at once and the mouth just stops. I don't know how much of it's important. I was having trouble at work. I had an attitude problem. I would like to say, you know, I'd grown into peaceful serenity by the time I was 4.5 years sober, but I hadn't quite reached it yet. I had chased a guy through the factory, fully intent on opening his head with a piece of pipe. And when I caught him, I got sick in my stomach, and I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. So I drove down to Laguna Beach to see a lady down there. I adore Chuck and Ellis. I've known him forever, and I've always gone to her for answers because I don't have time for him. It takes him too long to get to the point. I mean, I don't care that the goddamn deer in the canyon are his when I'm dying, you know, I just don't care. Elsa will give you a direct answer. I told Elsa the problem. I said, "Here's what I did at work." And she said, immediately, the minute I told her what I'd done, she said, "Well, why don't you try going to work for God instead of man?" Man, I was sorry I'd asked the question. I wish I'd been in the living room with Chuck talking about the deer. So I said, "Well, what do you mean, go to work for God instead of man?" She said, "Well, in essence, what would God want for you if he was your employer and you worked for him?" She would say, "Show up on time, treat everyone there like you would like to be treated, and expect nothing in return for your efforts, not even a paycheck." And then I was really sorry I hadn't been out in the living room with Chuck. I could still have been talking about the deer. So, I left and I went back to work and I tried it. And about a month shy of my 5th birthday in AA, I sat home in my apartment, still no car, still walking to work, and I wanted to die. I wanted to die. I had never ever considered suicide, ever, drinking and using. I had to get sober in AA before I thought about killing myself. And the first couple of years, it became a constant thought. But by the time I reached this 5th year, coming into, you know, my 5th birthday, I say this and it sounds like a joke, but for those of you who have been in this kind of depression, you know it's not a joke. The thought of suicide would have been a step up in the depression. I was so gone, I just wanted to die. I wanted to sit there on that bed in that apartment and die. I did not want to go on. I wanted to go on one more day. I had worked this program the best I could, and I couldn't go on. So in total desperation, I screamed at God. One of the problems I always had about God was my mind kept telling me that once I learned the proper metaphysical terminology so I could petition God's help with the right words, then he would help me. And I never could get a handle on the proper metaphysical terminology to petition God to help me. So in total desperation, in the worst depression I'd ever been in my life, I looked at the ceiling in my room and I screamed at the top of my lungs. I said, "If you're not there, I'm fucked!" And went to bed. And that was the prayer. And an interesting thing about the prayer was, I figured I was doomed now. If nothing else, just the language had finished me. Apparently, as long as you're speaking from the heart, God really doesn't care how you say it. I went to work the next day. I placed a brand new Allen head wrench into a brand new Allen head bolt. It slipped. I went backwards against one of the furnaces, crushed two vertebrae in my back, and I was taken to the emergency hospital. In the emergency hospital, they're saying nice things to me like, you can't go back to this line of work, you can't lift anything heavy, you won't be able to stand for long periods of time because my back is a disaster from the streets. I have a pelvis that's been snapped in half. I was the kind of maniac that people always hit in the back instead of the front. And, you know, everything has been broken, replaced, fused, bent, or some other half. You know, it's not where it's supposed to be. So after these doctors walk out of this room giving me all this charming information, my mind says to me, see? You dumb son of a bitch. I told you, last night you surrendered, and today he broke your back. I was so tired of listening to my mind that from down in here somewhere, in the general area of my stomach, a voice said to my mind, why don't you shut up? And I thought, I think I will. You know, I'm just too tired to worry. I decided to adopt the attitude that maybe breaking my back was a good deal. You know, I didn't know. That's another thing about judgments we make. Listen, I don't know why I'm going to tell this story. I rarely tell it, but I enjoy it. Because I'm very quick to decide, that's good, that's bad, that's good, that's, you know, and thereby change everything based on that behavior. There's a story about a guy, a farmer living in a small country in Europe, and he had a horse, beautiful, beautiful white horse. And the king came through the countryside and saw this horse and said, I'd like to buy your horse. And his farmer said, I can't sell you the horse, he's a friend. As much as he's a horse, he's a friend. And the king said, well, if you ever change your mind, let me know. I'll give you X number of rubles or whatever for him, an astronomical amount of money. The farmer wakes up the next morning and the horse is gone. And all the villagers run out to his farm and they say, oh, how terrible, you should have sold the horse to the king. Now he's gone, he's run away, that's such a bad thing. The farmer said, I don't know that it's a bad thing, I only know the horse is gone. About 3 days later, the horse returns and he brings a half a dozen of wild horses with him. And the villagers rush out to the farm and they say, oh God, you're right! It wasn't a bad thing that the white horse ran away. It was a good thing, because look at all the horses he brought you, and now you can sell them for money. The farmer said, I don't know that it's good that he brought 6 horses. I just know he's back and he brought 6 horses. Now the farmer's only son is busy riding these horses, trying to break them, you know, so they can be saddled for saddle, so they can sell them. And the farmer's son is thrown from the horse and breaks both of his legs. And again, the villagers rush out to the farm and they say to the farmer, oh my God, how tragic, you were right, it wasn't a good thing he brought the 6 horses because now your son has 2 broken legs, how sad. The farmer said, I don't know that it's sad, I only know that my son was thrown from a horse and has 2 broken legs. And at that time, this little tiny country had gone to war with a country 10 times its size, and they were taking all the young men from all the villages, and it was certain death to be sent to the front. And they came through and they took all the young men, but they didn't take the farmer's son because both of his legs had been broken. And again, the villagers rushed out to the farmer and say, oh, you were right. It wasn't a bad thing that he broke his legs. It was a good thing. And the farmer said, I don't know that it's a good thing. I just know that he has broken his legs and they did not take him to war. And it goes on and on and on. The judgment, always the judgment. So I decided with my broken back, maybe it's a good deal. What the hell? How do I know? So I set about doing what was put in front of me to do. I applied for vocational rehabilitation. I filed for disability insurance. I showed up at the doctor's offices. I wore my braces on my back. I did everything I was told to do. I went to voc rehab, which is a big... For those of you who have had to deal with vocational rehab and have my kind of personality, it becomes an interesting process. First of all, I'd taken 5 aptitude tests and I came out 5 different things. And I wasn't being funny and I wasn't being cute. They gave them to me on different days and I answered them honestly on how I felt that day, you know. One day I liked the outdoors, the next day I didn't like the outdoors, you know. So I came out a social worker, a forest ranger, a mechanic, and a classical or music and something else. They said, well, we're going to send you to UCLA. Got to get you a bachelor's degree in psychology so you can work with people in the field of drug addiction. I said, you got to be kidding. I said, I couldn't get through the 10th grade in high school. You're going to send me to college? I have an attention span of 4 seconds in that environment. So we went through this hassle for 6 months. 6 months. They couldn't find anything for me to do. They couldn't place me. And I just kept going along, walking back to my little apartment, walking to vocational rehabilitation or taking the bus, just going along, just saying, it's okay. My life is in perfect order. God is in charge. Even though it don't make sense to me, I know everything is fine. I'm sitting around in December of that year with a TV guide, and I'm reading it, and there's an ad in there for a writing course. It says, you know, would you like to be a writer? And something inside of me said, let's try that. Must have been the child. Childhood. Let's try that. So I said, okay. So I take this ad to my book rehab counselor, my next appointment, and say, I would like to try this. She laughed so hard, she almost fell out of her wheelchair, right? A lot of support from my state agency. Well, but she had everything. She had my files, she had my jacket. She knew all. See, here's what she knew. She was in possession of information she thought was relevant. She didn't understand spiritual matters. I'm a phonetic speller. You know, she had all my applications. I can't spell. I had failed English ever since the 4th grade. I've never read anything. I don't never had a desire to write. And just basically, you know, was thrown out of school in the 10th grade. I mean, she just couldn't see that this was a logical move on my part. However, God in his infinite wisdom had beaten bureaucracy in the state of California because she took it to her boss. Now understand, I had been on their rolls for 6 months. I was the only guy left from July. I mean, they had even placed everybody that had come in August and September, but there was still Bob Earl, you know. They hadn't done anything with him. This guy would have paid for basket weaving for me if I had wanted to go. So, they agreed to pay for the course. Now I send for the books. I get my books. I'm sitting down at home. Now, I'm going to tell you all this because I want you to hear how hard it is, how much thinking, maneuvering, and manipulating you have to do when you're on the path. I sit down, I get my book, I write my first story. I try and write a short story while I'm reading my books from school. It was so bad, it was just horrible. I mean, really bad. But I'm reading my books from school, and the books from school say, for your first thing that you write, it should be for a medium that you're familiar with. And I thought, oh, well, I never read anything, but I watched a lot of television. So I decide I won't write a short story, I'll write for TV. So I sit down, now I try and write a story for Bonanza, right? The Western, okay? It was as bad as the short story, it was really bad. The basic idea was good, because I later sold it as a Virginian, but the execution left a lot to be desired. So I'm reading it, and I keep reading my books from school. And my books from school say, when you're writing for the first time, not only is it important that you write for a medium you're familiar with, but it's also important that you write about a subject you're familiar with. I thought, well, I never lived in the Old West, for Christ's sakes. I don't know anything about cowboys and Indians and cows. You know, I mean, I get nervous the minute the asphalt disappears. I don't camp out, and I don't have a fishing cabin in the Ozarks, you know what I mean? But I thought I do know a little bit about crime. So I'll write about crime. So now I start watching the TV shows that had anything to do with crime, and I singled out Ironside because I liked it, because the mind, right? He thought all the time. I figured, okay, now I'll try and write a story that I haven't seen, you know, on TV before about on a crime show. I thought, well, I've never seen a drama about a righteous paper hanger. I mean, it's somebody who cashes tens of thousands of dollars with payroll checks. Having done a year for that, I figured I was qualified to write how not to do it. You know, I'd guarantee my character would get caught. One of the delights about writing is they don't all get caught. Well, anyway, I sit down and I start to write this story. Now, a friend of mine brings me home from the meeting. Now, I had made it a point not to know what anybody I hung out with did for a living. I mean, you may find it hard to believe, but I really was adamant about that. I never wanted to know what people I hung out with did for a living because my ego was so bent I couldn't afford it. Because I categorize people. So if Harry was a plumber and John was the vice president of a bank, and both Harry and John came up after the meeting at separate times and wanted to go have coffee, Harry's screwed, you know what I mean? I'll fix my own plumbing, but I may need John someday, see? So I never wanted to know what people did. So this guy's dropping me off in the meeting. He says, what are you doing nowadays? You know, and I said, well, I'm trying to write a story for television. And Jim said, oh, yeah, really? That's what I do. I said, what? He said, I write for television. So when you get done with the story, give it to me, and I'll read it, and then maybe I can be some help. See how hard I had to look for him? See how much thinking, planning, scheming, maneuvering, and manipulating I had to, you know, to find him to get on the path? How I had to dig him up, make 100 million phone calls, plead, beg, right? I get my story written, I give it to him, he reads it. He makes a dozen suggestions. I like 6 of them. I made those 6 changes, and I left the others alone, which is creative freedom as I understand it now. I get all done with it, and he says, well, listen, he said, there's a girl on the program who, and when she gets off work, she does my typing for me on the side. Would you like her to type it for you? I said, yeah, of course. You know, I know that Universal Television doesn't know that dead is spelled D-E-D. You know. They probably want that unnecessary A in there. So we sent it off to this girl to type. It's about 3 days out on here. I'm, you know, calm and peaceful, of course. Figuring out how the hell I'm going to get it to the studio. I don't know anybody. So about 3 days later, this girl calls me up. She said, listen, I just finished typing your story and I read it. She said, it's really good. She said, it's really very good. She said, did Jim tell you where I work? And I said, well, no, he didn't. Why? She said, well, I'm the secretary to the associate producer on Ironside. Would you like me to take it in and give it to him? Of course, you've got to be casual. Oh, well, of course. Not at all. Yeah. If you don't, I'll kill you, you know. See how hard I had to look for her? How much thinking, planning, maneuvering, skimming, manipulating I had to find her to get the story into the studio? So, anyway, they bought it. And I'll tell this story. Because, yeah, you can't get hurt. What the hell? Why am I... Okay. Hey, I'm never bored, you know. I mean, Home Alone is... You know, everybody's talking, you know. You ever get up in the morning, you go to work, it's like, you know, you're in the car alone, you feel like you're taking a lot of unruly kids to school that don't want to go. Everybody's got a suggestion on where to go, and nobody wants to go to work.
Well, let's go here, let's go to the beach, let's go here.
You know. Well, anyhow, Jim comes to me and I says, what am I going to do now? You know, they bought the story. He says, well, here's what you're going to do. He forgot I'm a very literal person, but I want to show you can't get hurt. You can't get hurt. Jim says to me, look, they're going to call you in and they're going to ask you if you've ever written a script before. He said, tell them no, you haven't, but you'll do a better job for them than their hacks at the studio because it's more important to you than it is to them. And they're only going to pay you $2,600 for the script and they piss that much away on a mistake on every show. Okay. Next day I go to Universal Studios. I'm riding up in the elevator in the Black Tower, scared to death, talking to God all the way up in the elevator. I say, if you don't get off the elevator with me, I am in so much trouble. You know, I am just in so much trouble. I get off, I wait, you know, finally I'm called in this guy's office, and I'm dealing with one of the, I don't know this, okay? I'm dealing with one of these people who eats people for lunch. If he can destroy a career, he'll destroy a career. I mean, you cross him and you're dead. I mean, everybody walks around him on tiptoes and they whisper in the hallways and nobody says anything out of line and you never challenge his decision, right? I don't know any of this. You know, I'm 5 years sober, you know, fruitcake man, just trying to, you know, do something here. I'm on a path I don't even understand. Sitting there with my little story in my hand, he calls me in, I go in the office, I sit down, and it's as Jim had written the script. The guy says, have you ever written a script before? Exact words. Exact words. I said, no, I haven't. I said, however, I will do a better job for you than your hacks here at the studio because it's more important to me than it is to them, and you're only going to pay me $2,600 for the script, and you piss that much away on a mistake on every show. Silence. Okay? The longest 3 seconds of my life. And then he starts to laugh, because nobody had ever talked to him like this, right? He laughs so hard he could hardly stop it. So he said, go home and write me a script. So I go home and I write him a script. I turn the script in, and they get, I get a lot of praise about the script. They say it's one of the best first drafts they read on the show. They were really impressed with it. They were so much impressed that after it was shot and done and everything was over, he said to me, go on home, think of another idea, come back Wednesday, and we'll do another show together. I mean, this is unheard of, right? So I go home, I'm stoked, I gotta get to write another TV script, you know, and I watch my show filmed. I mean, I'm so excited, right? I get home, and I sit down to think of an idea. Nothing. Huh? For 31 goddamn years, it had talked to me incessantly, and now all I want is one lousy idea, and it is blank, right? It's offering up zero, like a tomb, right? I mean, I'm crazy. I'm watching another TV show thinking maybe I can steal an idea from another show and take it in. I'm absolutely whippo. 3 days goes by, 4 days, whatever it is, I have no other idea. Nothing. I learned one thing. Show up. No matter what, just show up, you know. So I show up. I show up for what I know is going to be the single most embarrassing, humiliating moment of my life. This man is going to ask me for an idea. I've had days to think of an idea, and I don't have an idea. Not one, right? I walk in his office. I sit down, waiting for the guillotine to fall. He says, well, what'd you come up with? You got any ideas? I go, well, I gave it some thought, and he says, look, never mind, I got an idea. He said, we've been on the air long enough now for a couple of years. He said, we have a responsibility to the community. He said, I believe that. He said, I think the thing that we need to do is we need to do a really honest look at the upper middle class teenager and drug addiction. I thought, where the hell couldn't I think of that, for Christ's sake, you know? I'm the drug addict, I can't even come up with that, you know? I'm home with a blank mind up here. Anyhow, so we did the show. Well, the story's a little better than that. I start telling him what we can say about it, you know. He says, how do you know all that? And I thought, uh-oh. So I told him, I said, well, look, I said, I'm a drug addict, an alcoholic. I've been off of Narcotics and Alcohol with programs, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. He says, oh, that's nice. We talked for a couple of minutes more. He says, you won't be upset if we bring in a technical expert on the show, will you? I said, no, not at all. What was really humorous, they brought in a narc from the San Fernando Valley who I was taking a shot at. But we didn't talk a lot for a couple of weeks there. We just kind of acknowledged each other's presence and forgot it, you know. He just kept looking at me out of the corner of his eye, knowing I should be dead. So I go on with this writing career now. I go on with it for years, and I'm not enjoying it. I'm not having any fun with it. I go in the studio every morning on different shows I'm working on, and I'm worried, and I'm scared. And I drive in, and I know that this morning my parking place is going to be gone, meaning I'm fired. Today they're going to find me out. I don't know why I'm so afraid they're going to find out. The voices always tell me how they're going to find something out. They're going to do bad things to me. And I had a friend come visit me one day at the studio who had about the same amount of sobriety I had. And in 4 hours at the studio, he's one of these people that isn't into being cool. He had more fun in 4 hours of my career than I had had in 10 years. Right? I mean, he just loved everybody and got excited about the stars and the sets and the special effects. And he was crazy. He was absolutely nuts. I'm into cool. You can't ask questions when you're cool. So he found out more about how things worked that day than I knew. And I'm struggling with all of this. And I mean, things are happening to me like I wrote. What time is it? Okay. No, this is important. The vote is 3-1, guys. I had 4 days to write a script for Starsky and Hutch, so I wrote this script in 4 days. I worked day and night, turned it into them, jumped on an airplane, and went to Hawaii. I didn't even want to be around when they read it because I had to write it so fast. I got over to Hawaii. I've been over to Hawaii about 3 days, and a letter shows up in the mailbox where I was staying from the producers of the show. So I'm standing there in the driveway with this letter in my hand, and like any psychic alcoholic, I'm reading it through the envelope. And I know what it says. Tells me it's the worst goddamn script they ever read in their lives. Not only will I not write for that show again as long as I live, but if they have anything to say about it, I will never write for another show anywhere as long as I live. So I'm standing there, you know, boring holes in this envelope with my x-ray vision. And this impractical girl standing next to me says, "Why don't you open it?" So I open the envelope, and the letter says to me, in essence, it said, it was from the producers of the show, and I said, "We want to take time out to send you this letter to thank you for the beautiful job you did on the script that you turned in. It's got to be one of the two finest scripts we've ever produced. We appreciate the love and the caring that is in it. And rather than rush it into production, we will wait till you get back from Hawaii to make a few minor changes, and we'll take our time and make this episode with the care that it deserves." Signed, the producers. And I looked at this letter, and you know what my thought was? And what I said, I verbalized. I said, "Well, at least they're not pissed off." That's sad. That is tragic. Here I am, being praised and acknowledged for what I do for a living by the experts, by my peers, telling me how fine my work is, and I care so little that I can't jump up in the dryer. I should have been able to leap 3 feet off the ground in that driveway and go, "Yahoo! They loved it!" And jumped and did a little dance down the street, but I couldn't, because my self-esteem was so low, I just was grateful they weren't mad at me. All right? Now, a few more years go by, and I hit 17 years, and I'm nuts, and somebody says, "Nothing's changed, you know, I'm still working, I'm still writing, I still can't enjoy it, everything is the same." It's like, you know, the line about, you know, John isn't 20 years sober, John has done 1 year 20 times. I love that one, you know, you have a good year, you repeat it next year, why take a chance and do anything different? So I go in to meet with this therapist that I was suggested I go, and I picked one who I knew would really help somebody. And I sit down with this woman, and she says to me, "Begin with your childhood. Tell me a little bit about yourself." So I said, "Well, look, when I was 15 years of age, they threw me out of Manual Arts High School. I discovered drugs and alcohol. I began to drink and use. I smuggled narcotics, and I spent the next 11 years in the street. I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 26 years of age, and I've been clean and sober for 17 years. And she said, "Wait a minute." She said, "I said, tell me a little bit about yourself, starting with your childhood. You weren't born at 15. I said, "I don't remember anything back past 15. She got that great look, you know. "Oh, are we going to have fun here?" And I didn't know that anything that ever happened to me before 15 years of age mattered. See, and I had written probably 32 inventories in AA, and every one of them started at 15 years of age. And I now know that my sponsors, God bless them, the reason they never said anything is they couldn't remember back past 15 years of age either. So it's perfectly normal to them. You know, they didn't know any more about their childhood than I did about mine. So, she says, "Well, let's go back there and find out what went on." Now, what has happened here is we've changed the focus. For the first time in 26 years of drinking, using drug addiction and alcoholism, and now 17 years of sobriety, we've changed the focus. We're going to go back and see what happened. All right? Now, I'm going to summarize this because I don't have time to go into any of it. But in essence, what happened is this. I came from the standard household, alcoholic father, neurotic mother, that hangs in there, you know, till death do us part. Usually it's the kids that are doing the dying. And I sum it up this way, and this is the truth. My parents were smart enough never to get a dog. Okay? They knew a dog was too much responsibility. So they had a kid instead. I am the kid. They never cared enough to see that I had a room to sleep in. I slept on the couch in the living room. Nobody ever held me in their lap. Nobody ever embraced me. Nobody ever told me I was wonderful. Nobody ever told me I was important. Nobody ever told me I counted for anything. Everybody just told me to be quiet. Get out of the way. Move over there. Sit. I tried to give presents to my family, and they'd throw them away because I'd gotten them out of trash cans, which was the best I could do, you know, and they'd say, "Don't dig in trash," and they'd throw this present away. I couldn't bring anybody home from school because all of you who have been growing up with alcoholic parents, you know what that one's like, right? I mean, you can't afford to bring Mary and Bobby home to watch Daddy throw up straight in the air, you know, laying down on his back in the living room, which affects your childhood. You may not think that, but it has a little effect on how you feel about yourself and what you consider a normal relationship. And we don't win any rewards here, you know, in that area. Well, I don't have 7 hours to go into that area. So we dug and we dug and we found the pain. We found a little boy who had high arches, who had to wear special shoes. And their parents were too cheap to buy shoes that fit, so now I have practically a club foot on one foot because the shoes were too small and they turned the foot over. I had to be 40-some years old to start to run before I found that out. I always wondered why I walked a little strange. We discovered that there was an immense amount of pain for this child, terrible amount of pain for this child. We discovered that this child never did anything to deserve that pain. All he did was be born. That's all that happened. He was born. And so as I began to discover the pain the child went, see, I had forgiven my parents like they tell you in AA, like a good boy. Forgive mom and daddy, they did the best they could. So I said, yeah, okay, I forgive mom and daddy. Did the best they could. Went on down the road, okay? Now, as I start to discover this thing, I go into rages. I'm so angry I could kill. I mean, holidays with my parents, my father was dead, but holidays with my mother and my stepfather were just impossible. 45 minutes was maximum, because I'd sit there and look at this sweet gray-headed little lady, and I'd want to reach across the table and wring her neck like a chicken, you know, for what she's done. And I just couldn't stand it. The anger was so great. Finally, after I got all this immense hostility out, I was able to look at her one day and say, she did the best job she could do. She couldn't have done it any differently. She passed on to me what was passed on to her. She did exactly to me what was done to her. She did the best job she could. And I could forgive her. And I could love her. But you see, what I had done, which is an interesting thing nobody else here had told me to do, is another interesting thing happened. After I forgave her, I also discovered I don't like her. She's not a nice person. I'm sorry, guys. I'd love to tell you she's a wonderful, sweet, charming little old lady. She's not. She's not a nice person. She's a very evil little old lady. You know, and that's the truth. And I think one of the reasons it took me so goddamn long to forgive her is I thought in order to forgive her, I had to like her, you know. Now I can love her. It's a different thing. But what I had done is this. Yeah, I had finally done what AA said to do. I forgave them. I looked at them and said, yes, they did the best job they could do, both of them. They couldn't have done it any differently. But I also over here was saying they did a rotten goddamn job. It was criminal, the job they did to that child. Because you see, the minute I realized that child didn't deserve what happened to him, I suddenly started to feel like I accounted for something. Like I'm important. Like maybe I matter. Like maybe I'm worth taking care of. We don't take care of ourselves here. We have the worst health habits in the world. You know, why can't we take care of ourselves? You know, I know people that suddenly they'll be bouncing along and they'll have a few things out of line in their life and they'll say, geez, I'm going to correct all this. I need to stop smoking, get on a better diet, take care of myself. And away they go. We come in here and we are, by grace, we have this terminal disease lifted from us. Lifted from us. God removes from us a disease that can kill us, and we keep killing ourselves. You know, we eat pounds of sugar, tons of meat, drink gallons of coffee, smoke cartons of cigarettes, and just keep wiping ourselves out. Suicide prevention says smoking is covert suicide. It is a little tiny gun with a little tiny bullet. I believe that. I believe that. That's what we do to ourselves. Because you're not going to take... I will drive 100 miles to take you to the best doctor that I can find. I won't drive me 2 blocks. I will get so sick I'll be almost dead before I'll even go. And then I'll go to the closest guy, even if people tell me he's an ex. I've done it. I know. I don't know how to take care of me. Now, what I have discovered is this. We've gotten this, all these voices down to 4 personalities, and they're very distinct personalities, and they're wonderful. The first personality I've discovered is a child, a little boy, who lives inside of me. He's been in hiding for years. Years! He went into hiding early on. He looked at my family and said, oh, no way. I ain't coming out here for nothing, you know. Catch me in the next lifetime, sucker, but I ain't gonna play here, you know. I found this beautiful, blonde-haired, curly-headed, blue-eyed little boy in his little sailor suit, and he's adorable. And he's a good kid. And he loves teddy bears. And I have a house full of teddy bears. I have teddy bears in the living room. I have teddy bears in the living room, in the bedroom, in the den. There's 2 in my motel room that travel with me when I go places, wherever I go. One of them, he's the oldest one, his bear is 6. He's a wise bear. He takes care of the rest of them, you see. There are, if you're wondering what this pattern is on my tie, it's teddy bears, okay? Because my child loves bears, and if I give my child bears, my child's comfortable. And if he's comfortable, he won't fuck up the whole convention, you know? He's at peace. All he wants
nuts is a little protection, a little love, and some strokes, and he's the happiest kid in the world. And he's full of awe, and he loves new things and excitement. He can't stand the adolescent because the adolescent's in the cool, you know. The child will do anything. The adolescent just wants to stand there and look good, you know. Okay, now the child I adore. I have so much fun with this child. He's wonderful. The next is the adolescent. The adolescent is difficult. He's better than he's ever been, but he's difficult, you see, because all he's ever wanted in life is to find a girl with large breasts and a cashmere sweater and cop a feel behind the locker door in the hallway at school and not get caught. That's it. That is the sum total of his desire in life. He wants no more responsibility than that. And, you know, he'd be content if he gets back. Now, one of the things that discovering the adolescent helped me with is in running. I used to run in the high school. One of the places I trained was the high school near where I lived. And I'd be running around the track in the morning, you know, and all those gym classes would be out, and the little girls would be out in their little shorts running around the track. And I'd just be bowling along, and I'd be just fine, and I'd see them as beautiful children about to blossom into womanhood and hope that they had wonderful lives, and that would be the adult recognizing. But some mornings it wasn't quite like that. Some mornings I'd see them as potential dates, right? And I'd get nuts. I think, oh, God, you're so sick. You are so sick. You're one of these guys they write about that, you know, freaky for young girls. You are in serious goddamn trouble. Who are you going to talk to in AA about this one, sucker? Huh? If you guys or girls are wondering who the adolescent is, it's the one giving you whiplash driving down the street, you know. I mean, the adolescent could fall in love with a calf. Oh, that's a great leg. God, look at that leg, you know. He gets berserk over a leg. It's an example is I was running one day on San Vicente. This is a long street where I run. And during the summer, apparently, they turned out the girls' volleyball team from UCLA or somebody. But anyway, for a few days there were some girls, all of whom were over 6 feet tall, who were also running out there who were just gorgeous, right? And I'm trucking down the street one day, and coming up the other way is this brunette who's well over 6 feet, a wonderful body, with us about an 8-foot stride, running about 6-minute mile. And my adolescent sees her coming, and he went insane. You know, he says, oh, God, it's her. I know it's her, you know. And I'm trying to cool him down, because I got to pass this young girl, you know. And I'm trying to stem all this energy, and she's like nuts, right? And obviously she sensed it through a little smile, you know, just a nice little smile. Well, yeah, you know. He says, catch her, turn around and catch her. And I said to my adolescent, I said, I don't think we can, you know. He says, now is not the time to be a chicken shit. Go for it. I said, she's going awfully fast. Go for it. I said, let me warn you. I don't think we can catch her, but if we catch her, you're probably not going to be able to talk to her because I'm going to have developed a very serious breathing problem. Okay? He says, go for it. So I turned around and took off and did my best Alberto Salazar for about 3/4 of a mile. And at the end of 3/4 of a mile, I'm hanging, physically hanging on one of the banyan trees in the middle of San Vicente Boulevard, about to throw up. I have stressed my body to the maximum of its aerobic capacity, and vomiting is the only thing left it's going to do. And I'm saying to my adolescent, I said, see, I told you, you know. And so he shut up. I had a quiet run for the rest of the day. The only other real encounter we've had is I had a four-door sedan. I was getting ready to get rid of it, and my adolescent said, I want a Corvette. I said, no, I don't like Corvettes. He said, I want a Corvette. Corvettes are cool. And I thought about it for a minute. I said, okay, you deserve it. You never had anything in your life you didn't steal. You can have a Corvette. So I went and got him a Corvette. When I got him the Corvette, I was on safe driver insurance. I had the best rate available. And this is from a guy who used to use cars to get away from the law. I drove them through buildings, you know what I mean? It took me 10 years to get just normal insurance in AA. And I'd reached premium insurance. 2 years after the Corvette, I'm back on assigned risk, right? And I keep telling him he can't do that, you know. He gets out on Highway 5 and, you know, he couldn't help himself. Just, you know, the car's low and sleek and cool. And he's down there and his foot just would go to the floor. So I got rid of the car. Now, what had happened here is really interesting. Think about it for a minute. Just in my own quiet life with myself, I had behaved like a responsible adult. My adolescent came to me and said, I'd like a Corvette. I said, hey, you're a good kid. You deserve a little love. Here's your Corvette. I gave him his Corvette. He fucked up. I took it away. Now, the only other person left, the third person is the adult. Well, we'll talk about the other one. The other is the voice, the negative voice, which is always there in the morning telling me I'm going to die, that, you know, I'll never work again, I'll probably never write another word. I'm headed for the poorhouse, I have cancer in my foot. I mean, it's just always there to help me out. Any new idea I get, it says, don't bother, you'll fail. You know, I mean, it's always there to urge me on to better health and good things and take chances, you know. Don't go there, you'll look foolish. It's always worried about looking foolish. So that's the fourth personality, that voice. Then there's the adult. What has happened here is fascinating. I remember one day I was in therapy with my therapist, and she said to me, well, you know, we're talking about the personalities and things, and she said, well, who do you see in there? You know, who do you see that you like? And I said, well, there's a guy. I said, I see a guy inside of me, and he's really beautiful, and he's gentle. I said, but he's got gray hair. He's so old. She said, maybe he's an adult. I said, oh, Jesus, I hadn't thought about that. When you're a raging 47-year-old adolescent, what do you want to know about an adult? So I have met this guy now, this adult, this 48-year-old man who stands here now, along with the kid and the adolescent. We're all present in the counter board. The child loves Seaview. He really likes it. The adolescent is too impressed. Seaside? I told you the adolescent wasn't impressed. Anyhow, standing here in Jesus is this adult, male. And the thing about him that is really interesting to me is that he is an incredible guy. He is a gentle man, a very gentle man. He's a peaceful man. He's a man who's in touch with his feelings. The interesting thing is I spent my whole life drinking and using in sobriety, running from my feelings. And what I have discovered is I am my feelings. That's all I am. I'm not what I do. I'm not where I live. I'm not what the car I drive. I'm not the clothes I wear. I am only what I feel. That's who I am. And this guy is in touch with his feelings.
Yeah, right on.
We don't talk enough about feelings here. You know, we're afraid of the feelings and let people express themselves to be. And sometimes your feelings are inappropriate to the situation. Who cares? Just because you want to commit suicide because your car didn't start, as opposed to calling the auto club. You know, just look at it, understand it, and then call the auto club. You know, I mean, it's okay to have inappropriate. They're your feelings. It's me. It may not always be perfect. I spent my whole life trying to be perfect. My therapist won't let me use the word perfect, only control. She says, you don't want to be perfect, you just want to be in control, always. We had till 11, I'd talk about the alcoholic need for control. The killer. Anyhow, this guy is, I think the thing about the adult that really blows me away is the fact that if I met him, I would like him. You know, I live with an adult male now in my house, who, if I met him somewhere else, I would say, Jesus, he's really a nice guy, you know? And in sobriety, I've had a lot of relationships and a lot of disastrous relationships, and probably one of the nicest things that has come into my life now as a result of meeting the adult is I have finally met a woman. Couldn't understand why they were never around.
Yes, definitely.
You know, God knows I was looking. I used to sit home, I was so lonely, I'd say, oh, come on, Father, Jesus, I'm tired of being an example, you know, please. Single is terrific, all my plants are alive, what do you want from me, you know? I'm hopelessly in love, if you can't tell, and I think it's incredible. And that's the adult, and it's an interesting kind of relationship, brand new.
I'd go into how we meet, but it's toughier, you know. I mean, we meet, we have a lot of trouble in AA, right? Because we operate on the outside. You know, two adult people walk up to each other, and they try and be cool.
You know, you go to the meeting, the guy dresses up, gets his best clothes on, you know, going looking to dance or wherever. Girls do the same thing. You guys are just as bad as we are, you know.
We walk up. You know, the little girl inside the woman looks across the meeting and says, "Oh, God, there he is. It's Prince Charming. This guy can see the horse from here. Everything's okay. He's going to rescue me, take care of me. It's wonderful, you know." The guy looks across the room, sees her, and says, "It's her. It's wonderful. It's really terrific. You know, this is good." You walk up, say hi to each other, you talk for a few minutes, and what neither one of you realize is the little girl was seeing this man who's going to take care of her. And then you girls, you look at us like that. You don't understand what we're doing. We're looking for mommy. We may talk tough. We may look cool. We may talk tough. We may have a whole record of shotguns and shootings and homicides and scrap like that. But I want mommy, goddammit. And the first one blew it. I'm looking for one to do it right. And the first time you turn to me for help, I don't know what to do. You turn to me and say, "I have this problem and I want you to fix it." And I go, "Huh?" It's usually then that things begin to disintegrate. And from what I've learned in 21 years of sobriety around this joint is that the most important person in this room is me. It's me. If I take care of me, if I take care of me, I will be here to share with others what I have found here. What I have found here is beautiful. I wouldn't change any of it, but I've got to take care of me. So if you go home tonight, man, or as you sit here now, know that you're really okay. As is, you're really all right. We are God's finest creation. We are beautiful, beautiful, wonderful people. And you deserve to take care of yourself. Be good to you. Don't be afraid to take chances. We can have it all if we want it. We are truly blessed. I'm delighted to have been asked to come here and share. Just know that me and I love you, but that's not near as important as you learning to love you. I can look in a mirror now and smile at myself. I walk by mirrors occasionally, and I wink at me. I can remember in the beginning of AA, people say, "Look in the mirror and tell yourself you love you." And I'd go home, and I'd stand in front of the mirror, and I'd stare at this face in the mirror. I'd go, "Oh, Jesus, you're nuts. You know that? You're nuts." I'd walk away from the mirror. Now I can throw a wink at myself and say that I love you, you know. And it's okay to change the focus, guys. It's okay to look at what was done to you. Maybe you'll better understand some of your behavior today. And then when I understand it, I can change it. And people who know me for a long time and haven't seen me in 4 or 5 years, who sit down with me today, are stunned. They're not even dealing with the same human being. And it all has happened here and with those tools outside of here that are available to us. I love you, and God bless you, and thank you.